Well, I'm glad you agree with me that shirt sleeves are in order today. It's marvellous in Britain to be able to complain again about the heat. We have to complain about something in the weather, don't we? Would you turn to 1 Peter chapter 2 to page 217 in the New Testament section of the Church Bibles? And today we're going to be focusing almost entirely on two verses there, verses 11 and 12. We're going to slow down our mad rush through 1 Peter, and we'll take our time. Any of you who know the letter, or those of you who've cheated and read ahead, you'll understand that we're heading for minefields in the Sundays to come, as we look at the coming paragraphs. I mean, the most obvious one that you don't even have to think about comes when we reach chapter 3 and verse 1. And these two verses, verses 11 and 12, set out principles that the succeeding paragraphs are going to apply to different situations. And I thought it was right that we began by working on the principles. We'll deal with all the difficulties. Well, no, we'll deal with some of the difficulties in the coming weeks. Save them for then. But I want us to look at verses 11 and 12. Let me read them to you again. And then let's study them and see if we can get the principle clear and fixed in our minds. Beloved, I beseech you as aliens and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh that wage war against your soul. Maintain good conduct among the Gentiles, so that in case they speak against you as wrongdoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. These two verses are something of a pivot that will remind us of some of the truths we've already been taught, and then take us on into these other fields and areas that we'll examine in the coming weeks. But Peter begins by way of a reminder. Beloved, I beseech you as aliens and exiles. This is the truth he's already taught us, if you've been with us in this last month. He writes to them as beloved. He writes to them as beloved because he loves them. What's more, he's about to ask a lot of them. And you know it yourselves, don't you? When you're about to ask a lot of someone something that you know they'll find difficult, we often begin, don't we, by reminding them that we do genuinely love them. We're not asking them out of spite. But they're beloved not just of the Apostle Peter, but also of God. That, of course, is why they are aliens and exiles. It's been the great truth that Peter's wanted to ram home to us in chapter 1. That if we're Christian, if we're those who are genuinely beloved of God in that sense, then we have another world which is our home. We must live here as aliens and exiles. That's our position as Christians. It's a permanent one in this world. We only have a kind of temporary residence visa. And we have to hang on to that position with all the insecurities it brings for now. Because our ultimate security is elsewhere. And the pressure that the Christians to whom Peter is writing is facing, the pressure is to get themselves naturalized. It's the understandable thing, isn't it? When immigrants come into a new country, it's very often what they want to do. They want to get their naturalized papers. Then they can be truly whatever it is, American, British, they can play for our test team. Well, we need them fast, so we'll allow them in. But that's what happens, isn't it? You can take your place as a full member of the society, at home in the society. Peter, I don't believe, is writing his letter because there are false teachers with some devastating heresy that's sweeping the church. Though as Christians, that's often the target we gear ourselves up against, isn't it? We're worried about the big push that'll topple us from faith to unbelief. We're alert to it, we're trained for it, we're geared for it. Peter is writing about a much more insidious pressure. Pressure that can just nibble away at us bit by bit until it's got us at home in this world. That turns out in the long run to be just as damaging. That seems to me to be the profound disease that our church today, at least in this country, suffers from. And I suspect it's a far more common danger than the other. It's the one we're less on our guard against. So I hope that you're not too comfortable in this world. I know it's the holiday season, and holiday seasons is a good time to relax, and that's a good thing. It's a good time to slow down. Many of us need to slow down. That's a good thing. It's a good time to recharge, and that's a good thing. But it's a bad time to stop staying alert. And very often, spiritually, I stop being alert when I wind down in all the other ways. No, I am to stay Christian. I must remember I will still be an alien and an exile. When in Rome, do as the Romans do. No, says Peter. We're Christian. We live differently. I beseech you, as aliens and exiles, I beseech you, he says. And as soon as any New Testament writer says that, you know that the rubber is about to hit the road, that we're about to get to the practical application. And Peter is no exception. So he moves from the reminder to the restraint that he puts upon these Christians. Beloved, I beseech you, as aliens and exiles, to abstain from the passions of the flesh that wage war against your soul. I beseech you to abstain. Well, that's a good word for holiday time, isn't it? Peter is writing about the battle for holiness. And here is one of the keys to it, the ability to say no. It's a little bit of a letdown, isn't it? I mean, you won't find, as you read Peter's letter, any of this kind of macho talk that often goes around in Christian circles, telling us to face and fight and turn the world upside down. He just says, no, if we're Christians, we'll say no. There's enough of the Naaman in all of us to kind of find it hard to get worked up about something as simple as that, just saying no. Mind you, there ought to be enough of the realist in all of us to understand what a battle it is to say no. It's a bit of a letdown, isn't it? Because it's amazing, even though we know that the old phrase like let go and let God is only half a truth, it's amazing how strong the desire is to have some magic formula that'll lift me into a new spiritual stratosphere. At least, I begin to understand time and again how though I'll understand there isn't such a thing, I'll teach there isn't such a thing, I keep on wishing there was such a thing. The button I can press, the thing that'll do it for once and for all, and Peter's only advice to me, no, it's a command, isn't it? It's a beseechment, is to say no to the passions of the flesh. That's what I've got to go on and on doing. I went out to get a Big Mac for Claire and myself last night, and as I was driving to our local McDonald's and back, I was listening to a tape we got in the car. It was by one singer, and I was loving the tune and sort of, well, I don't sing along to things because my voice can't cope with that, but I was doing my equivalent of it. And then I began to understand at last what the words said. Well, whenever you turn any song back into, and you just read it out and make it poetry, it never helps any but the best songs, and it won't help this one. And I can't do the American accent. But listen to the words that were just sort of drumming in. It's actually got a very good beat to it, so it sounds even better, but I can't do any of that. You'll just have to have the boring, straight old-fashioned reading. Here it goes. I've decided to live as a believer. Turn my back on the deceiver. Being good is just a fable. I can't because I'm not able. So I'll leave it to the Lord. And it was only about the seventh time round, as I was drawn away from contemplating my strawberry milkshake, that it dawned on me what the singer was actually singing. Being good is just a fable. I can't because I'm not able. So I'll leave it to the Lord. And I got in whatever was left of my brain, this verse going round. And I finally put the two together and I realized that's not what Peter teaches. He does not say, "Beloved, I beseech you as aliens and exiles to leave it to the Lord to keep you from the passions of your flesh." No, he says, "I beseech you to abstain." He writes to me as a Christian as if I am able to say no to the passions of my flesh. One of the things I discover when I turn to the Bible, you see, is if I leave that to the Lord, he hands it right back to me. In fact, that's what it means to be converted. Just keep a finger in 1 Peter and turn back a few books to the book of Titus. It's page 201. Titus chapter 2 and verse 11. And Paul writes this to Titus, "For the grace of God has appeared for the salvation of all men, training us," notice this, "training us to renounce irreligion and worldly passions and to live sober, upright and godly lives in this world." One of the other translations puts it this way. It says, "The grace of God has appeared for the salvation of all men, training us to say no to irreligion and worldly passions." And you see, Paul is saying precisely what Peter's saying, isn't he? Paul is telling me that's why the gospel has appeared. That's why it's come to me. So that now I am able to abstain from worldly passions, or as Peter puts it as we come back to our verse, from the passions of the flesh. The gospel trains me to do that. Oh, it's a bit of a letdown again, isn't it? Because, of course, as we look at these words, as we think seriously about them, it becomes increasingly obvious to us, doesn't it, that this won't be a doddle. Many of us are not very good at saying no. Actually, we're being brought up in a society that's increasingly hopeless at saying no. It's no surprise that we find it hard. And we're to say no to the passions of the flesh. It's the kind of phrase that makes every red-blooded male think of sex. And I'm told from others that it makes every red-blooded female think of the same thing as well. Red-blooded is one of those phrases, by the way, that's... I thought about that last night. You know, it sounds as if it's limiting it to certain people, but when you think about it, it's all of us. If it's not you, see a doctor afterwards fast. Now, Peter is not talking about sex. At least he's not just talking about sex when he speaks of the passions of the flesh here. The New International Version describes it as sinful desires. Well, at one level it's more accurate, but it sounds less powerful, doesn't it? So if you can find a good phrase that combines them both, that's what we're after. He's writing to us as aliens and exiles, and he's reminding us that there'll be within all of us a selfish nature that will constantly want to make ourselves at home here, that'll constantly want the things of now. And we must learn to say no to them. Take the waiting out of wanting, maybe the catchphrase, but I doubt it's a Christian one. It's designed to arouse the passions of my flesh, my selfish nature. And I'll have to learn to resist the thought that I must have everything and must have it now. I'll have to learn to resist easy credit and easy debt. There'll be people, won't there, in County NatWest, who this morning and probably for weeks previously have been wishing that someone said no to the passions of their flesh, when they apparently took some shortcut in covering up the failure of the flotation of the Blue Arrow shares. Peter seems to have in mind, when we read on what he's got to say, our own self-assertiveness. Look how he's going to go on. Verse 13, he's going to say, "Be subject to every human institution." Verse 18, "Servants, be submissive to your masters." Chapter 3, verse 1, "Wives, be submissive to your husbands." It's as if the passion of the flesh that's most in his mind is that self-assertiveness that's in all of us, that selfishness that's in all of us, that'll want to make ourselves top dog, that'll want to make ourselves buck the system at any point where it rubs us up the wrong way. Now, beloved, I beseech you as aliens and exiles to abstain, to say no to the passions of the flesh. There's his restraint. Now, before we leave it, let me say this. It is actually a huge encouragement. A huge encouragement, particularly to any who are in desperately difficult situations. The more I look at verse 11, the more encouraging I find it at this level. Oh, I find it as discouraging as the rest of us, the thought that I've got to do battle and abstain from the passions of my flesh. But in this sense, it's a great encouragement to me. It tells me it is possible to be godly. It is possible to live Christianly in my situation. Whatever your situation is. You say, Hugh, you don't know my situation. No, I don't. But look closely. I know something of the situation to which Peter is writing. And he's writing to these Christians to tell them to be holy. And he tells them how. And these two verses are followed by three case studies, which involve authorities, verses 13 to 17, employment, if you can call slavery that, verses 18 to 25, and marriage, chapter 3, verses 1 to 7. What he has to say makes, in a sense, very different, disappointing reading compared with some of the theologies of today. I doubt you'd get the language of verses 13 and 18 and chapter 3, verse 1 as the basis for the papers that are read at Synod. Now, we don't live in exactly the same situation. And we must deal with the issues that come out of that in coming weeks as we come to these paragraphs. But we'll have to deal with them in such a way that we don't remove the force of what Peter's saying. And the thrust is surely this, and the thrust stems from verse 11. The battleground to being holy is within me. What wages war against my soul, according to verse 11, are the passions of my flesh. My soul, my share in eternity, cannot be threatened by tyranny. The emperor to whom we have to be subject in verse 13 was actually Nero. Now, you see, it's striking, isn't it? He doesn't need to be overthrown before I can live Christianly. Well, if he doesn't need to be overthrown, then I take it I can be Christian under the most authoritarian regime and under the fiercest persecution. I can be Christian. I can live Christianly. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to say, should we not vote this way or that way? We're not talking about that. We'll cope with that if we do at all next week. But I can live Christianly under those sort of oppressive circumstances. I can live Christianly under injustice. My soul, my share in eternity, cannot be threatened by that. If you don't have to abolish the slave trade, and you get no whiff of that in verses 18 onwards, before I can live Christianly, then whatever your place of work is like, you can live Christianly in it. My soul, my share in eternity, can't be threatened by others, even when they're as close and influential as your marriage partner. And chapter 3 says nothing about getting rid of your marriage partner. See, there's a godly way to live, even in those circumstances. You say to me, Hugh, you don't know my husband. Well, as long as you're not Claire, I probably don't. If you are, I've probably got a lot of homework to do. But you see, Peter is going to choose, when we'll come there, we'll see it, he's going to choose the worst possible scenario. He's going to write to the Christian woman who's married to the non-Christian husband, to the one who might have no respect whatsoever for her faith, and he's going to tell her how to live a godly life. It may be you're as vulnerable and as weak as the Christians to whom Peter is writing appear to be. There seems to be nothing they can do about injustices and persecutions. Well, he says to them, you can still live a holy life. Oh, you may seem strange living it the way you do, but then we are aliens. See, what I'm wanting you to realize as you look at verse 11 is this. We must be careful of our tendency at times to wallow in self-pity, to wallow in the difficulties of our circumstances, to, as we do so, actually begin to push the responsibilities for holy living onto other people. If only this was changed, or that was changed, or the other was changed, then I could live a Christian life. Or we look at someone who doesn't face the difficulties that we face, and we see the freedoms they enjoy and think, well, if I was in their position, of course it would be easy to live a Christian life. Well, it may be, but I doubt it, because it never is. But anyway, we're not in their position, and Peter's got nothing to say to us that'll get us out of the situations that his Christians are facing. He's just telling them how to live Christianly in them. He will not let me escape into self-pity or passing the buck. But he will not let me snap back at the injustices and fight them as if I was just the same as everyone else. Now I'm to live Christianly. I shall have to discover how that is in the practice as we look at the case studies. But do take this encouragement with you. As you go away to do the battle of saying no to the selfish desires and passions of the flesh, I can live a holy life. I can live Christianly. The question I have to ask myself when I face the hideous circumstances that some of us I know do is simply this: what is the Christian response? What have I got to say no to within myself? Now that's what I must discover first. That's how I start out on the track of living Christianly. And God can look at me in the midst of my difficulties and still see me living a holy life there. And Peter longs for his weak, pressured, soon to be persecuted Christians, that they'll be those kind of people. A reminder, beloved, we're aliens and exiles. A restraint, I beseech you, abstain from the passions of the flesh that wage war against your soul. And then lastly, a reason. Well, it's another reason, really. We've had one, that we're aliens and exiles and beloved. But here in verse 12 is his second great reason that we live this way. Maintain good conduct among the Gentiles, so that in case they speak against you as wrongdoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. Now, Peter's giving in verse 12 an evangelistic motive. An evangelistic motive for maintaining good conduct, for living this kind of holy life. Live such good lives among the Gentiles, he says, so that they'll all be converted. Well, that's the gist of it, but he's more realistic than that. Look how he puts it. Maintain good conduct among the Gentiles so that in case they speak against you as wrongdoers. You know, you'll discover that this very down-to-earth side of Peter's nature keeps creeping into his letter. He's going to urge the Christians to do the right thing. And if they're doing the right thing, he assures them, they might still get it in the neck. That it will still be twisted. It'll still be misinterpreted and misunderstood. And that may be the case, you see. Maintain good conduct so that in case they speak against you as wrongdoers. If you're going to live a slightly strange, a different, or what at times will appear odd way of life, then it'll also appear threatening. It'll also lead at times to accusations from people who don't understand the reasons and the motives. That's been true throughout Christian history. But he says, nevertheless, maintain good conduct among them, so that in case they do get the wrong end of the stick, in case they do accuse you as wrongdoers, they may in the end see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. It's a strange phrase, that day of visitation. It speaks of a time when God will visit the earth, perhaps in mercy, perhaps in judgment. In one sense, it looks ahead to that last great day when he'll come in both. I don't think it can be speaking of that day in particular, because on that day every knee will bow to Jesus. I think it's unlikely here that it's actually speaking of God visiting the earth in judgment. I think Peter's got in mind God visiting in mercy. It fits the thrust of what he said before and what he's going to say in the coming verses. He's longing for these Christians to live the good life so that God might visit in mercy, that their good deeds might be used by his Spirit to lead these Gentiles to glorify God and to be saved. So he says, maintain good conduct among the Gentiles. Live such good lives among the pagans, another translation puts it, so that they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. He puts it this way. He tells them to live like this among the Gentiles and the pagans. Why? Well, again, because Christians haven't changed down the years. And there's always been a tendency amongst us, hasn't there, to live one life in one place and another life in another place. The tendency to play the hypocrite. And funnily enough, it's always when we're here, when we're on a Sunday, when we're with our Christian family, that we live the good life. And it's always out there when the pressure's on that the compromises come and the good deeds are far rarer. And of course, nothing could be more ill-conceived, could it? I mean, if we're going to play the hypocrite, we ought to reverse it at any rate. We might as well be bad here, because we all know each other's rotten. Peter's said that in the previous verse, hasn't he? What's the mark of the beloved, of the Christian? Why, once they'd not received mercy, now they have received mercy. What's the mark if you're a Christian? You're in desperate need of mercy and you've got it. I know that about you. You know that about me. When I see you at your worst, oh yes, I've still got my framework wrong. I keep thinking how awful that he's done that. How can he be a Christian? And then I remember it's why he needed to be a Christian in the first place. We're going to let the side down, let it down here. You won't fool us. You shouldn't. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us to let the side down in any situation, does it? But you can see why he says, maintain good conduct among the Gentiles. We've got this extraordinary habit of putting on the best appearance on Sunday for an hour and a half, when very, very few of the Gentiles, the pagans, if you like, are around to see it. Not going to help them get converted too much, how we live in St. Helens. You know, when we know the right time to stand up and sit down, there's not a great deal else we've got to do, is it? Open our mouths and sing at the right moment. Say amen a bit louder than our neighbour. I mean, there's not a great deal you can do. But out there, you see, this is to be a missionary community. He spelled that out crystal clear, hasn't he, in verses 9 and 10. Look at them again. You're a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, that you may declare the wonderful deeds of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. I can't say I'm a Christian and I'm not interested in others knowing about this saving God. That's the whole point why you're a Christian in the first place, according to verse 9. At least it's one of them. Oh, I'm not to be arrogant. The one who does the declaring is the one who's been called out of darkness into his marvelous light. That'll keep me humble, won't it? I'm not holier than anyone. I'm just someone who's been rescued, telling someone else how they can be rescued. Oh, it involves life as well as lip. Yes, you're a holy nation. That's who declares. See, I constantly thank God for the life of the one who led me to Christ. That's what did it, I think, for me. But I want to thank God again for his courage in speaking as well. He only did it once, he only had to. But without it, I'd never have worked out why he was different. And you see, verses 9 and 10 come straight before verses 11 and 12. You don't need to be too bright to work that out, do you? So don't you think that the missionary community he's described in verses 9 and 10 is precisely the same community he's speaking to in verses 11 and 12? And he's beginning to tell us how this works out in practice. It's light years away from Mission 89, of course, because the Christians that he's speaking to aren't in any position to mount something like that. They're going to have to do it the hard way. They're going to have to live it out amongst their friends and their enemies. They're going to have to abstain, say no to self-indulgence, forgo rights even, so that they'll win others. Now, do you take being a Christian, being part of the missionary community, as seriously as that? That you'll live so that others may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. That's the reason for the restraint Peter wants to put on our lifestyle. Oh, it's got echoes, hasn't it, of other familiar words. Some of you have probably already worked them out, but just turn back to Matthew's Gospel. Page 4 in the second half of the Bibles. Matthew chapter 5. And verse 16. Peter's not a great one for direct quotes, but his letter is full of allusions to gospel incidents and to teachings of Jesus, and here's one of them. Matthew 5, verse 16, they're very familiar words, aren't they? Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who's in heaven. And here Peter comes and writes to them, maintain good conduct among the Gentiles so that they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. Oh yes, here's a God who's not just a Father in heaven, but a God who also visits in mercy and in judgment. And Peter longs that it'll be in mercy. And he's laying what responsibility is rightly theirs upon the Christians to whom he writes, that they'll live the good life, the holy life, that it might be in mercy when God visits, because those around them will be glorifying him. Well, let's pray that's our lifestyle too. Beloved, I beseech you, as aliens and exiles, to abstain from the passions of the flesh that wage war against your soul. Our Sovereign God, we thank you for the encouragement of that truth, for the reminder that those outside of us cannot damage our share in eternity, but we acknowledge the responsibility of that command as well. And we ask that through your gospel and through your Spirit, you would train us to be those who say no. And in your mercy, that as we live that way, so others might see and believe and give you the glory. Grant us the heart that longs for that for our neighbors, and the will that will say no to our own selfish desires for Jesus' sake. Amen.